Hamish blinked and then said, "Mention me much, does he?" "Mutters under his breath. That'll fix the red-haired bastard. I wonder if I could be there. Things like that. Now, the only place your man would want to be with me there would be if I were dying. Try this, Mary. He finds out the murderer and does a deal. You off Hamish Macbeth, and I won't charge you." "That's mad." "Aye, but this is your husband we're talking about. His brain hasn't recovered from those damn pills." "Oh, I could cope when he was just your old-fashioned drunk," moaned Mary. "I knew how to handle him." "Couldn't you have a word with Mrs. Daviot?" "Then I think I'd be the one that'd end up dead." "I'll give you a copy of some of the notes," said Hamish. "You'd better start giving me a daily report. Your man used to be a good detective, and I could do with all the help I can get." After Mary had left, Hamish reflected on the odd situation and thought that Blair was rather like a rabid dog. But he was relieved that Blair's obsession with Annie had fizzled out. Who would headquarters send to replace him? Then he thought, Blair will try to get some creature to do his bidding, someone who will report if I have any progress in solving the murders. In any case, it'll be some awful creep. Because Larry would not be returning, the policeman Blair was determined would replace Charlie was a small man called Silas Dunbar. He looked too small to be a policeman, but he had just scraped past the regulation height. It was his cringing air that made him seem smaller. He had sandy hair and pale green eyes, which peered out at the world with a furtive look. His nose was sharp and curved, and his mouth small and tucked in at the corners. He lived with his mother in a flat in Strathbane. He could not remember his father, who died when Silas was 2 years old. His mother was large and bosomy and domineering. It was she who decided that Silas must become a policeman. To make sure she knew what he was up to at all times, she waylaid Blair one day and explained who she was and what her concerns were. Blair immediately saw the possibility of having someone spying on Macbeth, and persuaded her that Silas's road to promotion could be through moving to Loch Dhu. Normally, Mrs. Edith Dunbar would not have relished the idea of her son having any freedom at all, but she had lately joined a country dancing class and had her eyes on a widower, and a sudden yen to get married again. And so one sunny morning, Silas drove his old Ford over the hills and moors and cruised down into Loch Dhu. Reluctant to spoil the day by reporting immediately to the police station, Silas parked on the waterfront and got out and looked around. Little white clouds like feathers covered the sky and were reflected in the mirror surface of the sea loch. The small whitewashed cottages with their flower-filled gardens formed a curve, and at the harbour tourists were getting ready to board Archie's fishing boat. He wished he had never joined the police force and had become a crofter or a forestry worker, and lived free of shackles in a place like this. He had his firm instructions to spy on Macbeth and put in a report at the end of each week. He reluctantly got back into his car and drove to the police station, parking it outside behind the Land Rover. He opened the garden gate and knocked on the door under the blue lamp, almost hidden under a cascade of red rambling roses. "Kitchen door at the side!" a voice shouted. Silas made his way around the side of the building to the kitchen door, which was standing open. Hamish was in civilian clothes. "So you're Dunbar," he said. "We'll deal with your bags later. I'm hungry, and it's lunchtime, so I'll treat you to a meal at the Italians. Come on, Lugs." Bemused, Silas followed the tall, red-haired sergeant and his odd-looking, blue-eyed dog. "The murderers are, of course, top priority," Hamish said, "but we still have a lot of irritating wee cases, and the Hall of Sutherland to patrol." They found a table at the window. Willie Lamont, who had once been Hamish's policeman, fussed around them, cleaning the table and even the menus, until Hamish sharply told him to take their order. Willie had married the restaurant owner's daughter and entered into a blissful life of discovering new cleaners. While they were waiting for their food, Hamish studied Silas. His shoulders were hunched, and his eyes were on the table. "Why on earth did you join the police force?" asked Hamish. "Willie, bring us a bottle of Valpolicella." "Yes, shouldn't you drink on duty?" "We're not on duty. Hop to it."
"I don't drink alcohol," said Silas.
"Alcoholic?"
"No,
So why? Silas hung his head. My mother signed me up for the Temperance Society. Did she know? Well, she isn't here, and a glass won't kill you. The bay window of the restaurant was open, and smells of pine, salt, tar, and afternoon baking drifted lazily in. They had both ordered one main dish of veal marsala. Silas took a gulp of wine and screwed up his face. It tasted sour, but a warmth spread up from his stomach, and he had a sudden desire to cry. He was wrestling with his conscience because he did not want to spy on this kind sergeant. Hamish studied his face for a few moments and then said, "He's done it before, you know. We are talking here about Detective Chief Inspector Blair, who has no doubt ordered you to spy on me."
"Yes,
but I can resign from the force," said Silas. "No, no, calm down. Take it easy. I'll do the reports for you. Settle in. Have more wine. Eat your food. Those are my orders. Maybe there's something in those interviews done by detectives and other coppers. I mean, after Paul's body had been found, the place was flooded with police asking questions. I've been concentrating too much on my own notes.
I went to Mrs. Mackenzie's before I heard there was room for me in the station," said Silas. "I'm glad I'm not staying there. All those religious texts on the walls. At least, she's the sort of God-fearing woman who wouldn't dream of withholding evidence."
"I wonder," said Hamish, "what would make her hold her tongue? Threats? No, she'd play the martyr. Let's have some pudding and then go back and find out what she did say." Silas had drunk nearly half a bottle of wine and longed to go to bed, but felt better after Hamish had made him a strong cup of coffee. They sat at the desk in the office, and Hamish scanned through the various reports until he said at last, "Here we are. Interviewed by Jimmy Anderson, no less."
"Did they find his mobile?" asked Silas.
"No, the rain came back and nearly killed Blair, who was jumping up and down. Let's see. Mrs. Mackenzie, outraged that anyone should even suggest there were shenanigans going on in her respectable establishment. Oh, I did read this, but it was her usual moan. I should have known from another case that she takes sleeping pills. What about the forestry workers who stay there? I mean, it was forestry workers who assaulted English in the first place." "Yes, it seems they all knew Alison had a habit of nipping out through the fire escape, but not one of them ever saw her meeting a man." "Back to Jimmy. Now, here's the thing. Jimmy says that the last time he was in Mrs. Mackenzie's parlour, she still had an ancient TV set. He says this time she had the latest flat screen. So let's fantasize. Someone knows something, and Mrs. Mackenzie might tell the police, and so that would explain the bribe of a good television set."
"If Jimmy noticed the television, then he must have thought it was suspicious. Not if a football match was on.
So we'll go and ask about the television set. If she took it as a bribe, then she'll splutter and protest. If a relative bought it for her, or she waves a receipt at us, then we'll come back and try to find something else."
"Is this police station haunted?" said Silas.
"No. Why?"
"I felt a sudden wave of cold. Mind you, I'm not used to alcohol.
Want to lie down for a bit, and I'll see Mrs. Mackenzie on my own?"
"No. I'll splash cold water on my face, and I'll be fine."
Chapter 8 "Fare for your honest sonsy face." Robert Burns. Women often took the bus from Knothen to Lochdu to shop at Patel's grocery because of his special offers. That day it was sliced cold ham. While her mother queued up, Fairy McSporran ran along to the vet's to look at the animals. She was fascinated with the wildcat, wondering if it would ever wake up.
"Can I hae a peek?" she asked Peter the vet.
"Aye, but don't touch anything." Fairy darted into the back room and then stopped still, staring at the cat and all the tubes. And then the cat opened its eyes and glared at her. She retreated backwards, her hand to her mouth, crying, "It's awake!" The vet came rushing in. The cat lay as before, eyes closed. "Come away, lassie. It's trick of the light." But the little girl seemed frightened, and Peter the vet comforted her with a lollipop out of a jar he kept for children. Refreshed and feeling happy again, Silas trotted along the waterfront with Hamish and the dog, Lugs. Several of his colleagues back at Strathbane had sympathized with him being banished to the backwoods. Silas thought of the awful jobs in Strathbane, mainly drugs and fights, and felt he was the luckiest policeman in the world. Hamish looked at him thoughtfully. "Not interested in anything to do with cooking or the catering business?"
"No," said Silas. "I was never allowed in the kitchen, so I don't even know how to boil an egg."
"Why?"
"I've lost 3 policemen to the catering trade, that's all. Clary is the chef at the castle, Willie of the restaurant you've met, and Dick has a bakery now in Brakey. The last one, mind you, Charlie, well, that was just a combination of love and a fellow policewoman who had gone off the job as much as he had."
"Can we expect a visit from your mother?"
"She is trying hard, but I told her it was a special assignment, and if she came, I would lose my job."
"Possessive, is she?"
"Very. Like I told you, she made me join the Temperance Society."
"Idle hands and all that," said Hamish thoughtfully. "Your ma needs an interest to take her mind off you."
"I'll find her something. So here we are at Mrs. Mackenzie's. She's gone in for gnomes, I see."
"Isn't it odd that gnomes have become fashionable again?" said Silas. "Particularly with people who like dreadful puns, like Gnome Alone or There's No Place Like Gnome. That sort of thing."
They walked up a brick path and knocked at the door.
"That's odd," said Hamish. "She gives the forestry workers tea, and usually she's at home now preparing it."
Few houses in Loch Doo had dinner or supper in the evenings. High tea ruled, that early meal consisting of 1 plate of food, ham and salad or fish and chips, and then bread and butter, scones and iced cakes, all washed down with strong tea.
"I saw a queue of women outside Patel's," said Silas. "Maybe she's there."
"Oh, of course. It's cold ham day. Cold ham for tea is the caviar of Loch Doo."
They strolled back, but there was no sign of Mrs. Mackenzie, and none of the women had seen her.
Hamish was suddenly assailed with a feeling of dread.
"Let's get back there. If no one answers the door, we'll wait for the forestry workers."
Again, when they knocked and rang the bell, there was no reply.
"Let's try the fire escape," said Hamish.
They walked round and into the square of weedy garden. Hamish looked up. The fire escape door was open. He ran up the stairs muttering, "Oh, God, no," with Silas at his heels. They ran along the corridor and hurtled down the stairs, crashing into Mrs. Mackenzie's parlour. She swung round and shouted,
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Your fire escape door is standing open," said Hamish.
"And so it is. There's been a bit of damp up there, and I'm letting the breeze in."
So much for the great detective showing off his abilities to his policeman, thought Hamish gloomily.
"It is these murders," said Hamish, "and the murder of Alison. I was nervous about you. Did you know any men calling on her?"
"No, and as I've told the police over and over again, until I'm sick of it, I don't allow gentlemen callers anywhere in the house except the back parlour. But no one even called on the lassie. She was a bit of a flibbertigibbet, but she always paid her rent on time."
"That's a really big television," said Silas. "Takes up most of your wall."
"Yes, my eyes aren't too good, so it is the great comfort.
I haven't seen you before, young man."
"I'm Silas Dunbar, Mr. Macbeth's new policeman."
"Aye, well, the lazy loon could do with some help before we all get murdered in our beds."
A streak of Highland malice gripped Hamish.
"Business must be good to afford a television set like that."
"It is more a case of God being good."
"Oh, really? Prayed, did you? And he sent it to land on your doorstep?"
"Don't be blasphemous, or he will strike you dead, Hamish Macbeth, and the little demons in hell will stick their pitchforks in you, and well you'll deserve it. The Kirk in Strathbane was holding a raffle for the children of the Sudan, and the first prize was that telly, donated by that sheik who bought old Urquhart's castle out near Moy Hall. I was down in Strathbane, and they were selling tickets in Harold's fishmonger's. He had a special on Coley. I bought 2 tickets, even though they were a pound each. I could hardly believe it when they phoned me. It was in the papers with my photo. See?"
She pointed to the wall by the window. Sure enough, there was a newspaper photo of her receiving a huge, beribboned box. Alongside her was the provost and a small man in Arab dress.
Hamish felt sulky and angry.
He had just demonstrated to his new policeman that he should have known about that television set, as it had been in the newspapers, and no doubt the hot topic of gossip in Loch Doo. "You should keep a better eye on what's going on here," he said. "I mean, this isn't the first time that fire door has been used by a criminal. I can't be everywhere at once, can I? I keep a decent house here."
"What about phone calls?"
"They've all got mobiles. Nobody uses the landline anymore. Now off with you, and use the front door. I won't have you pair trekking dirt through the house."
"Well, so much for one of my great ideas," said Hamish, when they were outside.
"Don't worry, sir," said Silas, taking a grateful breath of pure Highland air. "You've got to fantasize and theorize to solve anything. I mean, we're old-fashioned. We don't have forensics or DNA at our fingertips. We have to go through headquarters to get those, and I bet if you try, they fob you off."
Hamish's bad mood evaporated. "What a comforting sort of copper you are. I'm just going to look at my cat."
They walked towards the vets while Hamish described the rescue of Sonsy and how no one was to know he had a wild cat. His heart sank when he saw the cat, still, to all intents and purpose, in a coma.
"Back to the notes," said Hamish. "There must be something we've missed."
"I've got the names of the forestry workers who assaulted him," said Silas. "If you like, I'll go back to Mrs. Mackenzie's and have a go at them."
"That would be grand. I'll see you back at the station."
Hamish looked down and found Lugs at his heels. The dog always disappeared when he went to the vet's. He sat down in the office and pulled the large sheaf of notes towards him and then stared vacantly at the wall. There was something in Mrs. Mackenzie's conversation about that television that irked his brain, but he couldn't think what it was. He shook his head to clear it. He could hear Lugs in the kitchen banging his metal food bowl on the floor and went to give him some hard dog food because he knew that Lugs had been in the kitchen of the Italian restaurant and had probably had a large meal already. He made himself a cup of strong coffee and then lit the stove because the evenings were getting cold, although it was still not the end of August. He was reluctant to go back to work, but at last he dragged himself to the office. So many people had motives to want Paul English dead. It couldn't be Maggie Dinwiddie or her daughter, Holly Bates, no doubt waiting trial in America. They had been out of the country at that time. There was Caro Fleming, so cruelly tricked. The woman in Crask he had bankrupted. So very many people must have hated him with a passion. But one was around, the murderer, and that murderer must have been blackmailed by Alison. Alison lived in a fantasy world. She probably thought that Paul English deserved it, and there was no harm in getting a bit of money to keep her in the heavy scent she liked, and the sequined clothes she wore off duty. The sad fact, thought Hamish, was that if the murderer now felt secure, then there would be no more deaths. But then the murders would never be solved. Silas came back an hour later.
They were pretty open about it. English was a bit drunk, and hearing Glasgow accents, started to sneer about that city, so they took him outside to throw him in the harbour. You broke it up and handcuffed English. The workers had run off, but they didn't go back, or anything like that. Two of the other workers at Mrs. Mackenzie's heard her shouting at them for making a noise when they came in and giving them a lecture on temperance. So that's out of the way.
Hamish sighed. You'd better phone Blair. He'll like to hear about the failure. See if he's got anything. I'll talk to Jimmy. Jimmy reported that no one had ever seen Blair work so hard. In fact, too hard. A woman called Caro Fleming had complained about police harassment. Blair had gone as far as to arrest her for the murder of Paul English, have her brought in for questioning, and grill her so hard that it was only when she fainted and a doctor sent for that the full enormity of what Blair had done reached Daviot's ears, and Caro had to be placated with apologies and offers of generous compensation. "Well, he's planted Silas Dunbar to spy on me," said Hamish. "But Silas is a grand wee chap, and put me wise to it. Think of something, Jimmy. It's enough to drive a man mad."
"I don't think we're going to break this one, Hamish, and that's a fact. I've looked and looked at all the CCTV stuff, and there's nothing there. There's that shadowy figure you pointed out, but it's only a darker shadow in the shadows, and no idea that it's the murderer. The trouble is that the hospital is short-staffed and pretty empty at night.
It really looks as if Larry will pull through, but Daviot's feeling desperate. Police Scotland are angry at all this unsolved mayhem and threatening to send some heavy guns up from Glasgow. Have you any whiskey?
I think there's some of the Japanese stuff, if you left any.
That'll do, said Jimmy, opening the kitchen door and walking in. He was followed by Silas. Hamish poured 3 shots of whiskey and gave 1 to Silas. Take that into the office and spend an hour with the notes, he said. Then I'll make us some supper. Silas went off. He raised the glass to his lips and then froze as he heard his mother's voice at the kitchen door. Hamish quickly slammed the office door as he passed, and then Silas heard him say, Really, Mrs. Dunbar, your son is a grown man and on duty, and if you persist in following him around, then I will need to report it and he will lose his job. Do I make myself clear? Low-key apologies, and Silas breathed a sigh of relief as he heard his mother retreat. He gulped down some whiskey. It tasted awful. But a minute later, he felt a warm glow. I hope I'm not becoming a dipsomaniac, he thought guiltily. But Blair had been bullying, and his mother had always been bullying, and he wanted to hang on to this to-hell-with-the-lot-of-them feeling, and so he drank the rest of the whiskey, and, mindful of his job, began to study the notes. He desperately wanted to find something, anything. He finally heard Jimmy leaving, and then Hamish opened the door and came in. I don't think your ma will be around again. Has she any friends?
Oh, yes. Usually she's out at the church events all week.
As long as she's not lonely.
No, she won't be back. I heard what you said, and the idea of me losing my job means loss of face, and she couldn't bear that. Dad died 10 years ago, and she went to the kirk for comfort, and it somehow got the hold of her. But it keeps her busy and happy.
I can't be bothered cooking. I phoned my old sidekick, Dick, and he's got bacon baps. We can have those, and maybe call at the hospital afterwards.
Dick Fraser, to everyone's astonishment, had married the glamorous Anka, a dazzling Polish redhead who nonetheless shared Dick's passion for baking. Their baps were famous, and they did a successful business online as well as in the shop. Silas, seated in a comfortable armchair by the peat fire in their upstairs living room above the shop, with a bacon bap in one hand and an excellent cup of coffee in the other, wished with all his heart that he could keep this job as long as possible. Hamish had been telling Dick all about the case. I think it's some lucky amateur, silencing people as he goes along, said Dick. And someone, funnily enough, not scary. I mean someone who could say, well, he hurt you too, and he had it coming to him, sort of thing. Maybe even a sort of personality you might want to protect. Sort of person who says, I did it for you as well as for myself.
That's a thought, said Hamish, but it'll make it all the harder to find. The only people before nasty enough were Maggie Dinwiddie and her daughter, but old Granny was off busy blackmailing someone else.
Are you absolutely sure these forestry workers are in the clear? Asked Dick.
Yes, Silas cleared that lot up once and for all.
English was stabbed with a broad blade like a sword, said Dick. Anything there?
Not that can be found, said Hamish. You can still buy all sorts of swords at car boot sales and at auctions. Somewhere in these notes that I've been going over and over, there's a weak spot. I swear there's something I'm missing.
Anka came in, carrying a tray of desserts.
You must try these, she said. It's fresh strawberries, jelly and fresh cream, crushed meringue, and with just a dash of kümmel.
This is delicious, but how much are you charging? Liqueur like kümmel is expensive.
Not really. There's less than half a teaspoon in each one. We charge quite a lot, £4.50, and yet they fly out of the shop. We're going to take some goodies up to Larry at the hospital when he's up to eating proper food again. I gather he's still not up for questioning yet.
Not that I've heard, said Hamish. I don't think he'll really be able to tell us anything. Some idiot of a nurse passed him earlier and said he was asleep and she didn't like to wake him. He probably didn't see a thing.
What about forensics?
Nothing.
Wore gloves, and what's more, wore some sort of forensic suit.
Could be one of you, Lord. Blair's still crazy.
No, clean and sober, but cracks are beginning to show. He's determined to find the murderer, and so he's turned to his old methods of bullying people and getting into trouble. It won't be long now before we get some heavy mob up from Glasgow.
Reluctant as they were to leave the bakery, Hamish and Silas went out into the deserted evening streets of Brakey.
"It seems a shame to spoil such a visit with work," said Hamish. "Let's go to the hospital and see if by some miracle any of the night staff remembers anything."
But although they diligently questioned everyone who had been on duty on both the nights, the first attempt on Alison's life and then the successful one, there seemed to be nothing new. Silas reflected that this was what was known as real police work, grinding boredom, asking the same questions over and over again. "No wonder they call us plods," he thought.
"Yes, I know," said Hamish, as if Silas had spoken his thought aloud. "But there's nothing else to do but go over and go over until something breaks."
But when they returned to the station, there was something that drove every other thought out of Hamish's mind. There was a message on the office phone from the vet. "Your cat has made a miracle recovery." Leaving Silas behind, Hamish pounded along to the vet's.
"It's a real miracle," said Peter.
The large cat was free of tubes and wide awake. It lazily regarded Hamish and gave a slow, rumbling purr.
"Never seen anything like it," marveled Peter. "But Hamish, I've treated Sonsy in the past, and I swear this isn't Sonsy."
"I know my own cat," said Hamish, "and I'll take her now."
He gently lifted the large cat. Its rumbling purrs reverberated through him. Lugs was waiting outside.
"Here she is," cried Hamish, but Lugs ran away, scampering in front of them until he reached the police station.
When Hamish entered, Lugs was hiding under the kitchen table.
"You silly dog," said Hamish, "don't you even recognize your old friend?"
Silas came out of the living room. The cat eyed him balefully, and Silas felt a superstitious frisson of fear.
"Glad you got your cat back, Hamish," he said. "I'm just going to take a walk before bedtime."
Silas went out into the cool calm of the evening. He saw a gnarled little man wearing a tight tweed jacket sitting on the harbour wall, rolling a cigarette.
"Over here, son," he called.
Silas went to join him.
"I'm Archie MacLean," he said. "You're Hamish's new copper."
"Yes, I'm Silas Dunbar."
"Was that Sonsy I saw him bringing home?"
"His cat's made some sort of miraculous recovery."
"I used to give Sonsy a bit of fish. I've nothing but coley, and I don't know how folk can eat that. We used to throw the damn things back. Now the fish and chip shops try to pass it off as cod."
"What's up with it?"
"Oily, that's what. I was thinking of going to the pub. Fancy a wee dram?"
Silas hesitated only a minute. One could do no harm. He would not admit to himself that the cat had scared him and that he was reluctant to return. He spent a pleasant time in the pub, but then decided two drinks were enough. Somewhere at the back of his mind was a feeling that something important had been said, and it was something he ought to tell Hamish. But Hamish had gone to bed, and no doubt the cat had gone with him. He went into his own bedroom after undressing and washing. He was just climbing in when the door was nudged open and Lugs came in and jumped up on the bed.
"No, you don't," said Silas, trying to push the dog off,
but that was when he realized Lugs was trembling.
"There now," said Silas, "you can stay. Did the cat frighten you?"
He patted and hugged Lugs until the animal stretched out beside him on the bed, heaved a little sigh, and fell asleep.
"Can't blame you," was Silas's last remark. "That damn cat scares me as well."
The following weekend, late in the evening, Priscilla Halbert and Smythe arrived at the hotel and found that Elspeth Grant was one of the guests. The two met in reception.
"Been to see Hamish yet?"
asked Priscilla. She had heard all the rumours about Hamish having had an affair with Elspeth, but did not want to believe it.
"Not yet. In fact, I was just on my way. I hear he's got his wife back."
"What wife?"
"Sonsy. I think he's tied closer to that animal than to any woman."
"I'll come with you," said Priscilla. "I rather liked Sonsy, but isn't it a bit late for a visit?"
"If he's asleep, the bedroom door will be closed, and we can just walk away." They entered quietly by the kitchen door. The bedroom door was open.
"Must be in the living room," said Elspeth.
They stood in the doorway of the living room. Hamish was asleep on the sofa. On his lap was the large cat. As they stood at the entrance to the room, the cat slowly turned its large head, stretched up one large paw possessively on Hamish's chest, and gave them both a yellow stare. of such malignance that Elspeth gasped and drew Priscilla away. Outside, Elspeth, her odd silver eyes gleaming in the twilight, said, "I don't know what Hamish brought in from the moor, but it's evil, and it's not Sonsy."
"You must tell him," said Priscilla.
"He won't listen to me. The only thing that's going to get rid of that creature is a silver bullet." Chapter 9. I would like to be there, were it but to see the way the cat jumps. Sir Walter Scott. To Silas's relief, Sonsy would not get into the police Land Rover. To go off with Hamish and Lugs, leaving that sinister beast behind, gave him a feeling of reprieve. There had initially been many visitors, but they soon found out that Hamish would not listen to any remarks about the cat not looking like Sonsy. Even his friend Angela Brodie said sadly to her husband that she thought Hamish was bewitched. Also, to Silas's relief, Blair had stopped calling, demanding results. So the days of cruising around Hamish's extensive beat were relaxed and pleasant. One day, when they had been fishing on the River Anstey and caught 4 trout, Hamish said, "Well, that's 1 each and 2 for Sonsy. They are not getting much out of the loch these days, mostly things like mackerel and cawley, and I can't stand cawley." Something tugged at Silas's memory.
"I've got something," he cried.
"Doesn't it seem to be anything on your line?" said Hamish.
"Not that. Mrs. Mackenzie. Don't you remember? She said she had gone all the way to Strathbane because Harold the fishmonger had a special on cawley. That's how she got tickets for the raffle and won that television. But why go all that way and pay the expense of the bus fare to buy a type of fish that Archie might have given her for nothing?"
"You mean, could the raffle have been rigged?"
"Something like that."
"What are the reports on this sheik?"
"Highly respectable. Bought Ferrycastle from the Urquhart family. Long name, but shortened locally to Sheik Khalid Al-Fakhr. Comes for the shooting every August, but usually stays on until the end of the year. Contributes a lot to local charities. I see you've got a silver cup in your living room that you won at a clay pigeon shoot. Well, I saw in the paper that there's one at the Sheik's this Saturday. Let's see if there's time to put your name down. See, he'll probably award the prize, and if you win, maybe you could be having a wee word."
"If he's all that respectable, how could he have rigged the prize?"
"I don't know," fretted Silas. "But we've got nothing else."
They hurried back to the station. After various phone calls, they found there was still time to enter, but the fee was £59.99.
"Why can't they just say £60 and be done with it?" complained Hamish. "Hey, where's Sonsy? Got some nice trout. Where are you?"
But there was no sign of the cat. Hamish slumped down in an armchair and looked bleakly around.
"Now what do I do?" he asked.
"Just wait," said Silas. "It'll be back." Before Saturday, Silas suggested that Hamish might like to get some practice in, but Hamish was afraid that if Sonsy came back, the sound of his gun might frighten her away. When they drove down to Ferrycastle on the Saturday, Hamish began to feel silly. It was all too far-fetched. It would have been cheaper to simply ask Mrs. Mackenzie about the peculiar lure of cheap cawley and see if that made her look guilty. He brightened when he learned there was not only a trophy but a cash prize of £1,000, for he still owed the vet money for Sonsy's treatment, the money from the fundraising having quickly disappeared. He glanced at the competition and recognised 2 crack shots up from Glasgow and began to wish he had practised. But when he started shooting, it seemed as if his eyes had never been so sharp or his aim so accurate. Silas joined in the loud cheers as Hamish went up to the rostrum to collect his prize. But it was being given by Lord Sampson, an industrial bigwig surrounded by the worthies of Strathbane.
"I would have liked to thank the Sheik himself," said Hamish.
"He's down in London. He would have loved your performance. Never seen shooting like it."
"Now what?" asked Hamish when he joined Silas. "I can't complain. It's been a waste of time, because I need the money."
"I remember now," said Silas. "It was the Kirk running the charity raffle. Probably that big Church of Scotland in Strathbane. My mother goes there. We'll drop in on her. Maybe we might get Lugs a wee treat. He's a grand dog."
"Funny how he and Sonsy used to be almost inseparable," said Hamish.
Well, like I said, the general opinion in Loch Doo is that you want that cat so much to be Sonsy, you've become blind to the fact that it isn't.
Bad injuries and ill treatment change people's characters, protested Hamish. Animals as well.
But I found some photos of Sonsy. She looks a wee bit smaller, and the markings are lighter.
I'll have a proper look when I get back, said Hamish. They say love is blind, and I really do love that cat.
That cat, whatever it is not lovable, sir. It scares the pants off me.
Here we are, that wee bungalow.
It was a pebble-dashed building. The garden in front had been paved over and nothing planted. A fairly new Subaru was parked outside the front door. Mrs. Dunbar opened the door before they could ring the bell. She was a round woman with a dumpy figure wrapped in a cardigan and a long tweed skirt. Her face was round as well, with faded blue eyes and a button of a nose. Her hair was thin and wispy.
"This is a treat," she cried. "Come, Ben, and I'll put the kettle on."
Silas and Hamish followed into a small kitchen.
"It's like this," said Hamish. "There was the grand prize of a big television set to be won in a raffle funded by the local sheik. Was there any chance that the lady who won it was told to buy tickets, that in some way she might have been selected?"
"Oh, the Kirk would never do that,"
Mrs. Dunbar looked genuinely shocked.
"But as my wee boy is a policeman now, I'd better hear hard think."
She deftly tipped boiling water into a teapot and then proceeded to load a tray with all the things she considered necessary for afternoon tea.
"I hope you are taking good care of my boy, Sergeant."
"Like a father," said Hamish solemnly.
"I must say I never thought that the police could be so caring. Thank you, Sergeant," she added, as Hamish relieved her of the heavy tray. "Follow me."
The living room contained the usual three-piece suite, although this one was covered in frilly cushions and fake silk throws of an acid pink colour. There was a copy of Landseer's Stag at Bay over the empty fireplace, and photos in silver frames of Silas at various ages on top of an upright piano. As instructed, Hamish put the tea tray down on a coffee table, and they all sat around it.
"The only thing," said Mrs. Dunbar, "was about a month before the raffle was drawn, I was asked if I knew anyone worthy who deserved it. You know, a regular Kirk member. I think the elders were beginning to be worried that such a prize should end up in the hands of some lowlife. I'll give you the phone numbers of two of our elders, and you can ask them."
"No. Fairy cakes, anyone?"
Once back in the police Land Rover, Hamish felt a little pang of guilt that Silas had brought two biscuits for Lugs. He felt he had been neglecting the dog for a long time. When he entered the police station, he knew immediately that the cat was missing. He had to admit to himself that when the cat was there, there was always an atmosphere of threat. He went up and down the village calling for the cat. He asked around, but no one had seen it. He called at the vet's, but Peter had not seen the cat.
"Tell me, Peter," said Hamish, "did you ever think the cat might not be Sonsy?"
"All the time. I tried to tell you, but you were so determined that cat was Sonsy, you wouldn't listen.
Don't go rushing back to Ardnamurchan, Hamish. Sonsy's in her proper place, and the other cat must have returned to the wild where it belongs." Silas was surprised when Hamish showed every sign of pursuing the Mrs. Mackenzie angle. To even suggest the Church of Scotland had rigged the raffle amounted in his mind to sacrilege. The first elder he phoned, a Mr. Witherspoon, answered mildly enough that he had never been asked to suggest anyone, and the idea was ridiculous. Such a great man as the Sheik or any of his aides would not trouble themselves over fixing a raffle. The next elder, a Mr. Noble, immediately flew into a temper and threatened to report Hamish to his superiors. Hamish eventually managed to soothe him, because any report to his superiors could mean Blair getting hold of this line of inquiry.
"There must be something in it," he thought. "I mean, why would a woman go all the way to Strathbane to buy two cheap fish?"
Well, the simple way was just to go and ask her. Mrs. Mackenzie answered the door to him and then stalked in front of him into her private parlour, where the large television set was showing the umpteenth episode of an Australian soap.
"It's only got a few minutes to go," Mrs. Mackenzie shouted above the noise from the set. "You'll have to wait."
Someone on the screen was in a coma in hospital. Hamish reflected that when soap operas felt they were running out of plot,
they always put one of their characters in a coma, and someone at the bedside was always being told, "Do talk, she can hear you." When it finished, Mrs. Mackenzie turned the sound down but left the picture on. Little coloured lights from the screen flickered across her thick glasses. "Why did you go all the way to Strathbane to buy Coley?" asked Hamish. "I mean, it's possible Archie would have given you a couple for nothing, and Patel sells them cheap." She turned and addressed the television set. "I just happened to be in Strathbane, that's all. I often go on a Saturday. The buses are expensive these days." "Not for me. I'm an old-age pensioner, and I've got a free bus pass." "You go to the Kirk there, rather than here?" "Not all of the time." "Do you often buy raffle tickets?" "Why all these questions? If you must know, I was waiting for the bus when Mr. Alexander drove up and asked me if I would like a lift. I says I, "that would be real kind, because often the bus is late." He dropped me at the fishmonger shop, and he says to me, "He's selling raffle tickets. You should have a flutter." I was that amazed, because Mr. Alexander is an elder of the Kirk. Well, I didn't like just to ask, which is why I bought the Coley first. But Mr. Alexander fair urged me, and he waited until I had bought the tickets. Hamish studied her, and Mrs. Mackenzie studied the floor. That was nearly the truth, thought Hamish, but there's something she's not telling me. On the wall was a piece of embroidery in a wooden frame bearing the legend, "His eye is on the sparrow." Hamish pointed at it. "Believe that, do you? That he knows everything we say and do?" "Yes." "Does he know when we are lying?" "What is this? Yes, if you must know. Not telling the whole truth is a form of lying, wouldn't you say?" She suddenly went into a rage. "Get out of here. I don't need to answer stupid questions. Out." Outside, Hamish knew he should try to find this Mr. Alexander, but he longed to spend the day looking for his cat. Yes, he finally admitted, he had probably made a mistake. The cat might not be Sonsy, but she could be injured. He could send Silas, but it was getting late, and Silas was so in awe of the church that he wouldn't really press this Mr. Alexander. He decided to go back to his notes and try to find Mr. Alexander in the morning. He was pleased to find that Silas had already found a phone number and address for the elder, which he had got from the Loch Doon minister, Mr. Wellington. So Hamish walked up the moors at the back of the station, whistling for the cat the way he used to whistle for Sonsy. But nothing disturbed the calmness of the evening. He walked sadly back indoors. He had wasted emotion, time, and money under the delusion that he had found Sonsy again. He felt almost as if he had been bewitched. The villagers had been frightened of the cat, and Elspeth had left a message for him saying she could not visit him until he got rid of the animal. The clay pigeon prize money paid the rest of the vet's bill, with a third left over, so Hamish suggested they go to the Italian restaurant and treat themselves. "I've been thinking," said Silas, "that I should tell Mr. Blair I will not spy on you, and if he insists, I will need to report him." "Don't do that," said Hamish quickly. "I think Blair is still not quite right in the head, and can be dangerous. Just feed him a bit here and there. He thinks I'm stupid most of the time, so he won't be all that surprised. He thinks I solve cases by sheer luck, that's all. I mean, I could be wasting time and effort thinking that Mrs. Mackenzie knows something and was being bribed in a complicated way. But I've got nothing else. I mean, the woman is famous for spying on our borders. If she didn't have such cheap rates, she wouldn't have anyone at all." "Maybe it could have been like this," said Silas. "They want to make a big show of the presentation. What if it's won by some criminal, or blousy slag from those tower blocks by the docks? Won't look good in the papers." They decided to massage it a bit, get someone worthy to win it, someone outside Strathbane. So they hit on Mrs. Mackenzie. Could have gone wrong. Mrs. Mackenzie is the kind who might think buying a raffle ticket was gambling and a fast track to hell. I'll know better when I meet this Mr. Alexander. Silas woke suddenly during the night with a feeling of dread. The door of his bedroom was nudged open, and then Lugs jumped on his bed and lay trembling beside him. There seemed to be an air of menace enveloping the station, and then it was gone. "That damn cat," thought Silas. "It hasn't left. It's lurking around somewhere." Mr. Jonathan Alexander, a retired coal merchant, lived up on the moors outside Strathbane in a granite stone villa on a windy hilltop. He was at home and ushered them into a cold living room where little icy draughts scuttled across the stone floor, covered only in a hooked rug. The walls held bookshelves full of dark, leather-bound tomes. One small paned window rattled in the gale. He was a tall, knobbly sort of man. His cadaverous face had two knobs above his pale grey eyes, and his large hands were knobbly with arthritis. Hamish's curiosity overcame him. "Why build your house up on the hill, where there's no shelter?"
"That was my father's doing. He always was a silly old fool," said Mr. Alexander with surprising viciousness from one who was supposed to be a Christian. "So what brings the police to my humble abode? I could be of help to you. I was in the Black Watch for my sins."
The man's a walking cliché, thought Hamish. A Mrs. Mackenzie won an expensive television set in a raffle.
"Oh, aye. And what would that be doing with me?"
As it was for a worthy cause and the TV was very expensive, we wondered if there was any way that the winner could have been chosen.
"Well, don't ask me. I just do all the work, while the rest of the worthies ponce about."
"But is it possible?"
"No. Daft idea. Too complicated."
He had begun to look almost truculent.
"Look, laddie, my corn's hurt, and I want my tea. Bugger off."
"So that's that," said Hamish back at the station.
"It was just a mad idea of mine. You know, in books, it's always the one you'd least suspect, whereas in real life, it's usually the obvious one."
"Who's that, sir?"
"As you're not cheeky, you can call me Hamish."
"Oh, what's her name? The minister at Knothen."
"But I've gone over and over the interviews. You weren't the only one. Jimmy Anderson and Blair both interviewed her. On the night of English's murder, and at the estimated time, she was seen by passing villagers in the manse, in her study, working at her desk."
"Oh, I tried to find a way around it.
I mean, that wee lassie McSporran was telling the truth about the carnival knowledge, as she called it. So I thought English was always after money. He had his wicked way with her. What if she told him she's left it all to charity instead of him? Sort of a test of his true love and all that. He gives her the heave-ho in his usual charming way, and she turns murderous."
The wind rose suddenly and moaned round the station. Silas shivered.
"I feel that cat somewhere near. I'll go out and look for the poor thing," said Hamish. "Come on, Lugs."
But Lugs shuffled over to Silas, laid his chin on Silas's boots, and looked pleadingly at Hamish.
"Oh, stay where you are, you stupid dog. Could you cook us a fry-up for supper, Silas? There's venison sausage, eggs, bacon, and haggis."
"Will do. Do you want me to report that business about the minister to Blair? Send him down the wrong rabbit hole?"
"That's a good idea."
Blair said he would check the interviews and get back to Silas, which he did after 10 minutes, calling Silas every sort of fool. The woman had an unbreakable alibi, which Silas should have known if he had a brain in his body, and on went Blair, until Silas said firmly that somehow Hamish was sure Maisie Walters was the murderer. After he had rung off, Blair stared at the phone, overcome by a sudden craving for a drink. He had run out of pills and had taken no mind-bending substances. Drugs were dangerous, he told himself, but what harm could just one dram do? He needed to think. Silas was young and naive. He wouldn't lie. Despite all appearances to the contrary, Macbeth might be onto something. He set out for Knothen. Maisie Walters herself answered the door to him, her face darkening when she saw who it was. Blair gave her an oily smile and said,
"I'm only here because it baffles me why Hamish Macbeth should think you are the murderer. Tell Macbeth I am contacting my lawyer this evening and I am going to sue him."
Blair felt alarmed. He could not produce proof because that would mean admitting he had asked Silas to spy on Macbeth.
"I haven't any proof he's actually saying that," blustered Blair. "Just a rumour."
"Then either get proof and come back with it, or go away before I report you for police harassment." Blair was furious when he left the manse. He drove to Loch Dhu and parked on the waterfront. He decided to creep round the back of the station and listen at the kitchen window. He couldn't bear the idea of a wasted journey. The craving for drink was worse than ever.
As he tiptoed to the side of the station, he heard a loud hiss and looked down. A large cat, with a dead hen in its jaws, was staring up at him with a yellow, baleful stare. It dropped the hen, and Blair could swear it was ready to leap on him. He turned and ran for his car.
"Did you hear anything?" asked Hamish, putting down his knife and fork.
"No, but I feel something. I think your cat's about the place."
"I searched and called while you were making supper," said Hamish.
"What on earth made you think it was your cat? Everyone in the village is saying it wasn't in the least like Sonsy."
"I wanted it to be, and I have a feeling she wanted to be too.
Is that mad?"
"I suppose it could be," said Silas cautiously.
"What do you think Blair will do?"
"He may try to get something out of her and fail, and that'll make him mad. If he goes back on the booze, that's when you're really in trouble. He'll maybe persuade Deviot that you'd be better off in Strathbane. Next time you call, you'd better tell him you hate it here."
A report of a break-in at a shop in Brakey kept them busy the next morning. Silas said he would do the paperwork, and Hamish decided to drive to Cnothan just to question one of the witnesses. Perhaps they might have been lying. How he detested Cnothan, a sour village where the inhabitants boasted of keeping themselves to themselves. There used to be a Sergeant MacGregor to cope with the place, but he had retired, and it had simply been added on to Hamish's extensive beat. The witness, a George Green, actually lived in what had been Sergeant MacGregor's bungalow. The front garden was packed with the dreariest bunch of plants Hamish had ever seen in one small garden. He recognized laurel bushes and Wellingtonia. The rest he didn't know, but they were flowerless and dusty and depressing. He was just about to walk up the garden path when the sound of a small sob stopped him. He unclipped the torch from his belt and shone it into the foliage from which the sound had come. The terrified eyes of Fairy McSporran stared up at him.
Chapter 10.
"I believe cats to be spirits come to earth." Jules Verne.
Hamish crouched down. "It's me, Sergeant Macbeth. What's the matter, lassie?"
She put her hands over her face and began to rock to and fro.
"I'd best get you home," said Hamish, becoming alarmed.
"No," she screamed. "Ma will say I'm telling lies, and the minister will put a curse on me. She can be in two places at the one time."
"Come with me, lassie. I think what you need is a chocolate ice cream.
With a chocolate flake in it.
Double if you want it."
One small grubby hand reached out from the bushes and found Hamish's hand and held on tightly. He lifted her up in his arms and walked down to a cafe on the main street, where he bought her something called a 99, which came with a stick of flaky chocolate thrust into the cone, and asked for another flake. Oh, the magic of chocolate, thought Hamish, watching the delight on the tear-stained face. Better than a tranquilizer any day.
"We'll talk a wee bit about what scared you. Now, Fairy, I'm sure you believe what you think you saw, but folk canna be in two places at once."
She looked at him solemnly.
"I saw her at the Girl Guides. She needed some string, so she says to me to go into the vestry and look in the green cupboard, and there might be some on the bottom shelf. Mr. Macbeth crossed my heart and hoped to die, but when I opened that door, she's there, looking at me. I ran like hell and hid."
"Listen, Fairy, I believe you, but it is our secret, right? Can you keep quiet for, say, a couple of days, and I'll buy you another 99?
"Another 99, and I can shut up for a year," said Fairy.
"Right. When you finish the next ice cream, I'll take you near your home and drop you off. Is the church locked during the day?"
She shook her head. He bought her another ice cream and waited patiently, very patiently, because Fairy, having got over her fears, seemed determined to make it last as long as possible. When he had at last got rid of her, he went up to the church, entered the vestry, and opened the green cupboard. There was nothing sinister there, only rusty tools and boxes of string and tape. Was Fairy nothing more than a fantasist telling elaborate lies? But she had been very frightened. He tried the other cupboards. Only the minister's robes, along with the choir's surplices. Rather high, even for the Church of Scotland, thought Hamish.
He was about to leave when he sniffed the air and smelled smoke. He went out and looked at the sky. A thin plume of smoke was coming from the vicarage garden at the back of the manse. He ran round and vaulted over the fence as the gate was padlocked. A brazier was burning brightly over by the far wall. He ran up to it. There was one piece of cardboard, which he jerked out by using a branch. One colour-photographed eye stared up at him. That was it, he thought. Fairy had seen a large cardboard photo of the minister in the cupboard, because he recognized her even from the small piece that was left. His heart began to beat with excitement. Say, Maisie left a large cardboard cutout of herself by the window on the night Paul was murdered. That would be what the witnesses saw. But the evidence was almost gone. Fairy would be dismissed as a liar. His phone rang. It was Blair.
"You're to get the hell away from that manse," he shouted. "Divya is furious. You're trespassing without a warrant."
"I'm leaving now," said Hamish mildly. "I saw smoke and went to check, that's all."
"Well, get your scrawny arse back to Lochdoo, toot sweet, and tell Silas Dunbar to move back to Strathbane next week. He's not helping up there."
Hamish's heart sank. He could hear all the sounds of a pub in the background. Blair, back on the booze, would be even more obstructive and vicious. He felt depressed as he made his way back to Lochdoo. He would have been even more depressed if he had seen Fairy being dragged along in the direction of the church. But he was soon to find out the result. He had only just entered the station when he was told to report to Strathbane to answer a charge of paedophilia. By the time he had untangled the charges against him, he felt exhausted. Fairy, desperate to keep their secret, had agreed that Hamish had taken her for 2 ice creams, and, yes, he had put a hand on her knee. Fortunately for Hamish, the waitress, like the late Paul English, prided herself on her honesty and said roundly that Hamish had never touched the wee lassie. Before he left, she had asked the officer what was up with the wee girl, and he had said she was worried about schoolwork. Faced with this, Fairy had hung her head and said it was the truth, but that she hadn't wanted her mother to know she was worried about school. Finally released after signing what seemed like endless statements, Hamish finally returned to Lochdoo to find a distressed Silas, who had received an email summoning him back to his duties in Strathbane. Hamish had forgotten to tell him about Blair's call. He went to bed, vowing to find some way of keeping young Silas, and, more important, to find evidence of those cardboard photos, or photo. They must have been used at some time for something. Just before he went to sleep, he remembered that the Curry sisters sometimes went to services in Knoffen. He became determined to question them in the morning. Silas decided that if he really had to go back to Strathbane, then he would resign from the police force, or maybe, just maybe, get a transfer to a pleasant town like Perth. He quailed at the thought of living with his domineering and possessive mother again, while at work he suffered the lash of Blair bullying. Hamish told him after a phone call from Jimmy that 2 top detectives had been sent up from Glasgow to take over running the case, and Blair looked as if he was about to have an apoplexy. The phone rang before Hamish left the station. It was Blair demanding to speak to Silas.
"I'm afraid Constable Dunbar is out on a case," said Hamish. "Tell him to drop everything and get down here."
"As he is being moved at your request, sir, then you must fill in all the necessary forms in triplicate, giving reasons, and..." Hamish grinned as Blair slammed down the phone on him. He saw Silas watching him anxiously. "You are not, repeat, not going back to Strathbane, laddie, so stop looking like a ghost. I want you to go to Knoffen and start asking round if there were any cardboard cutouts of the minister at any time." After Silas had left, Hamish strolled along the waterfront to the Curry sisters' cottage. He pinned a smile on his face as Nessie berated him for being lazy, and her sister echoed her every word. When she had worn herself out, he started to question her about any big cardboard photographs of the minister, but neither of the spinster twins had seen anything like such a thing. Over in Knoffen, Silas was meeting with the same lack of success. He phoned Hamish, who said, "Maybe it was something in her past. Maybe when she was married to yon oilman and afore she became a minister. Come back here and we'll start ferreting."
Their ferreting took them along to the offices of the local newspaper, the Highland Times. Hamish felt almost a pang of loss when he remembered the days when Elspeth had worked for the paper, before she became famous. Maybe he should have proposed to her then. They asked if they could search the photo files. Two thick box files contained photos of Minister